Have you ever been curious about using AI to do your note-taking after your therapy sessions? The admin juggle is real. Using AI to transcribe my notes has quite literally changed my practice forever.
I'm going to be running a 70-minute webinar that you can join live and you can have access to after and watch as many times as you would like. I'm running this on Friday, the 25th of April, 2025. So put the date in your diary.
This is a step-by-step guide on how to use Heidi Health, the note-taking AI software for therapists. If you're curious about how it works, including concerns around consent and GDPR, or if you're already using it and want to ensure that you're maximising the features, then this webinar is for you. Join me and sign up at masteringtherapy.com or click the link in the show notes. Welcome. I'm so excited to share with you that season two of Mastering Therapy is about to arrive. So this season, you can expect a broad range of therapeutic models. For example, we have a clinical psychologist and trainer in transactional analysis. I interview a family therapist on how we can integrate systemic principles into our therapy sessions. And I have a fantastic episode with a psychosexual therapist. And in line with the ethos of this podcast, which is to take insights and put them into action, these are not just interviews. I invite my guests to share insights directly from their experience, which isn't something that you're going to get from a textbook. They give us their go-to resources and helpful questions and metaphors that we can use as part of our sessions. The purpose of this podcast is to create a platform from which we can learn from one another, we can increase confidence and be inspired by new tools and ways of working. So consider it a little bit like your weekly CPD. Have a listen to the following preview of some of the guests featured in season two. Dr. Jill Stoddard, clinical psychologist.
One of the reasons I love being a psychologist is because you can wear so many different hats. I was interacting with an author and she was announcing that she had just written her 27th book. And I was like, so was this the one where you finally felt legitimate and no longer felt like an imposter? And she said, I'll let you know when it happens. You don't have to wait until you feel confident to go after the things that matter to you. And nor should you get on this hamster wheel of constant achievement in an effort to outrun this, because it doesn't work and it leads to burnout. Isn't it interesting that a phenomenon that's affecting high achieving women suddenly gets rebranded in our culture as a syndrome? If half the population experiences it, then it's just normal, right? It's not a disorder, a disease, or a pathology. Adam Grant, in his book, he talks about three benefits that feeling like an imposter might have. And so this is the person who has very, very, very high standards. And as long as I can keep maintaining those standards, I'm proving to the world that I'm competent. But of course, all of these end up being a trap, because at some point we're humans and we make a mistake. Let's say you have the opportunity to apply for a promotion and you think, I'm a fraud, I'm not good enough, who me, I don't have enough skill or expertise, and so you don't apply. Well, the minute you give yourself permission to not do it, you get relief. Living full size is like that full size candy bar rather than the little candy bar. If you sit around waiting, it might never happen. We stay trapped in stagnation due to a perceived gap in confidence or knowledge or expertise.
Matt Hussey, psychotherapist.
Where my clients get the most stuck is when I'm just almost an empty vessel, right? That's a very psychodynamic way of doing therapy, which was my first training. We had this brilliantly empty teacher who personified this, like, I am a vase, I am an empty vessel, please pour into me what you need to, and I will just silently hold it. I hated that. I absolutely hated it, because for me, it made me feel like I was alone in the work. I want the client to feel I'm in there with them. We've gone down into that basement together and they're not alone. It's so important to take part in the work and to not just be this cool, distant observer. I think some people get very scared about power and they try to be powerless, and that's not the point either. I think the point is that a lot of our clients want to feel led. What I learned from that is, and what I encourage my therapy clients to do, is to prod this thing that we're doing, this relationship that we're creating, to be annoyed with it, to be frustrated, to, why aren't you telling me what to do? This is all welcome. We have to have been to the outer edges of our own material and sat in the darkest depths of our own material and learn to live in it before we can really go and help someone else do it. I am not an expert in you. You are. What it feels like to be you what it feels like to hold those memories, what it feels like to have had those relationships, what it feels like to be sat in front of me. You are the expert, not me. I started this weird experiment where I invited mental health professionals to join the WhatsApp group. And every Thursday, I asked them a question about them and their practice, and everyone just talks about it. And it's been going for a few weeks. There's over 100 people in there.
Dr. Hannah Bryan, clinical psychologist.
EMDR is where my huge passion lies. It sparks lots of joy in me, and I really see a lot of change happen clinically through EMDR. I think that most of us are capable of way, way more than we believe ourselves to be capable of. So being on the receiving end of coaching was such a powerful journey. And that was where the EMDR supervisor came from. People that come to me for EMDR informed coaching, I've ended up working with a lot of psychologists that have been moving and transitioning through practices, but wanting to build confidence, wanting to branch out and feel that they were more capable of doing things. I've worked with quite a few elite athletes, but might have some blocks, some blocking beliefs or some early experiences that hold them back. Business owners, entrepreneurs who are running their own businesses and coming up with challenges and wanting to move past that onto something newer and different, but feeling a bit stuck and blocked within it. What I've developed has been created through my experience and through what I wanted. One of the key differences in thinking about the difference between therapy and working with the coaching framework is that you're just perhaps working in a slightly different way with less of a focus beyond the big T trauma on the past and more of a focus for the future and the positives and what you want to be different. Therapy could go on forever. Coaching could go on forever because there's always stuff that we can work on. So what I really like is to try and set a boundary about that. It's looking what's connected to the things that are going on in the here and now, and then having that real laser-like focus on that. I remember in the practical on my training doing a future template on wanting to be more confident and have a voice in these meetings rather than being too scared. And I can honestly say that from that day, I just felt different in the meetings. I just started running a forum for clinicians that are EMDR trained and interested in working within a coaching framework. So people are welcome to join that if they want to explore some more of these ideas.
Lou Cook, psychosexual and relationship therapist.
Nearly 50% of people are dissatisfied in their sex life. So much of our lives feed into sex, and sex feeds into so much of our life. So we don't just put it in a little box and send it over in that direction separate to the rest of us.
Sex is massively impactful for people, and yet we don't ask about it.
If someone tells me they're on an SSRI, I'm almost guaranteed to assume that they're having some form of sexual dysfunction. I mean, it's 60% of people on SSRIs are reporting that. If you're working with relationships, you should know how to work with sex. And if you're working with sex, you should know how to work with relationships.
Yeah.
Get yourself to a place where you are feeling confident, where you at least know what your biases are so that you can bring a non-judgmental stance to the room. You want to find out, do you experience pain or discomfort when you're having sex? Because so many people aren't asked that question, even if they're talking about sex with a therapist. If you're not having fun while you're having sex, you're not going to want to have much more sex. I think there's a difference between feeling clueless and not knowing versus feeling closed and judgmental. And I think it's important, it's our duty to make sure that we are inclusive and welcoming of diversity, and that we have some level of competence around diversity. One thing I've learned about people that have experienced sexual trauma in childhood is that there's a huge, huge piece of them that feels complicit. A lot of people can subvert what happened to them in the past. They can subvert it into fantasies and fetishes and kinks to kind of reclaim their power. Fulfilling sex lives in their older years are people who have adapted, have learned to adapt.
Mm.
And there's so much shame and stigma around aging and sexuality.
Jed Smith, consultant, family and systemic therapist.
It's the systemic approach that generally can apply to all. A lot of mental health approaches zoom in on the problem or the referral. In the systemic theories, we zoom out and look at the big picture, the context, because it will make sense in a context. Family therapy can be, and often is, very philosophical and full of scientific language, sometimes jargon, which most of us struggle to understand at times. Family therapy is so much fun, actually. Mental processes that go on in therapy are, I think, more complicated than any of us can possibly understand, and it will sometimes surprise us. Once you pass through the doors of systemic perception, there's no going back. It literally changes the way you think. You know, everything is connected. Relationships and context is everything. A very useful technique and way of thinking that I like to use is called the internalized other interviewing. The questions do the work. Finding ways of asking powerful, facilitative questions that make people think differently. Challenge is never easy, and we have to do it very carefully and with a judicious use of language, which takes a long time to perfect that art, and I would call it an art. Often when people say, I don't know, it's not because they don't know. What I feel like saying is, I think you do know, but you're afraid to say. What do you think when I say that? Does that offend you? And a mantra I have is, the thing is not the thing. And they say, what do you mean? I say, well, the thing you want to tell me, which is an account of what happened last week, is not actually the thing. We don't want facts much. We want meaning. What is the meaning of this event or episode that happened last week?
Wendy Castellino, psychotherapist.
When the person actually thinks about a traumatic memory, they can actually have a nurturing figure there with them, almost supporting them along the process as well. Mm. Feeling nurtured and supported when you're actually going through a trauma experience is one way of using it. The nurturing figure can actually go in and say to the actual abuser, you know, this was not acceptable. You need to be reprimanded for what you did. You can change, you can hope, you can create these neural pathways, and this is one of the most effective ways of doing it.
Dr. Tracy King, clinical psychologist.
Eric Byrne was the psychiatrist that he was the founder of TA in the 1950s. And it's a personality theory in this world. It seems that if I actually express myself, no one's going to respond. So I'm making a life decision of do not feel, which in TA terms is called an injunction. A client that I had a while back, she had an experience whereby she was told by her mother that she didn't want her and that she tried to abort her. So it's a very strong do not exist injunction. This enables us to sort of understand a little bit about what someone's parental growing up experience might have been from the language that they're using. So you're asking them, what happened when you fell over? Did somebody come to you and explain that that's okay to be hurt? Did somebody say, get up and get on with it? We're looking to understand the impacts of things, not necessarily blame or judge anyone for that, but understand that the way anyone responds initially is a survival adaptation. It's the best way possible. We know how to do something with the resources we've got at that time. When someone's having a response, it's about maybe saying to them, how old do you feel right now? It's a really simple question, but it can sometimes really orient someone back to where they were and where that came from. Part of TA therapy is about helping people to have that emotional regulation, be responding in the present and be authentic to themselves. Part of TA is about sort of stripping back the layers of the onion to reach somebody's authentic self. If you stay an adult, you've got the best chance possible of the other person responding differently. The life script can be something like a winner script, where we always think we are going to do well at stuff. Or it could be something like an almost script. Like you might hear people saying, oh, I nearly made it in that relationship, or I nearly got that job. It's helping people to map the part they play unconsciously into recreating their early life experience in all of their future relationships or interactions with the world, themselves and others.
Dr. Clara Davey, clinical psychologist.
It's so important when people are experiencing infertility and loss to feel like the other person understands, that they get it, that they are, you know, kind of very empathic, compassionate and supportive. People will come to a clinician really hoping for, okay, this is somebody who gets it. It's approximately one in six couples who experience infertility approximately 1 in 3 people who experience a miscarriage who went on to develop PTSD. So about a third, so it's really high rates. Perinatal teams tend to not see people who've had a loss because they are there for someone who has a baby, and that can be quite triggering actually. I think there is more out there telling people that actually, yes, you might be experiencing trauma symptoms, like actually, yes, this could cause PTSD. Fertility treatment takes over everything, and a lot of people don't understand. But also, whether it is infertility or whether it's experiencing a loss, it suddenly separates you from your social network. Suddenly the world minimizes because everything feels triggering and difficult and hard. And of course, that's going to impact on anxiety and depression levels. Sometimes people will say, you know, there's one day where I'm completely bereft, I can't do anything, I can't stop crying, and they're beating themselves up because they're not coping well enough. And it can be really helpful to know actually that's really normal, and that's, you know, that's okay. I've put together a form so people don't have to keep retelling their story, and that explicitly says this is what I need to hear in this appointment, or this is how I want my baby to be acknowledged. The NICE guidelines would say wait 4 weeks before you intervene, and I think actually when you meet someone who's had a loss, there will naturally be 4 weeks while they're telling you what they've experienced. So I think the fertility network is a good place for if people are experiencing infertility. And the Miscarriage Association do groups for people who've had a first trimester loss. We're getting more and more evidence of, you know, recent events, protocols and things that actually it's quite useful to intervene sooner rather than later. But of course, there is an importance in checking, yes, is this just natural, you know, grief and loss that will pass.
Suzanne Zeedyke, developmental psychologist and research scientist.
I took this radical decision. I stepped out of the academic environment in order to disseminate what I call the science of connection to the wider public. Really understanding attachment, really understanding connection, understanding the biology of relationships is both fascinating and deeply unsettling. By the time you're a year old, you have learned whether the world is trustworthy or not. One of the things that we often miss is that attachment is a biological process. The biology insight helps all of us, including therapists, to be more curious about what is going on with someone and helps us to be more forgiving of ourselves and other people. I talk about saber-toothed tigers and teddy bears. If you were in a room with a saber-toothed tiger and you're about to die, your body would do all of those automatically, whatever it thought would keep you alive. Babies have saber-toothed tiger moments all the time. And we often miss that as grown-ups, so we don't help. One of the reasons I use this analogy is because I find that it helps people to step into helping and into curiosity. And it moves us out of the self-critic. It moves us out of the irritation with other people. It moves us out of getting stuck in big feelings. And it helps us to step into, oh my gosh, are you scared? All of us can grow a stronger internal teddy bear.
Dr. Michaela Thomas, clinical psychologist.
Everyone's ADHD. Everyone here, there, and everywhere is getting a diagnosis. And that's an example of a microaggression that immediately makes me feel this is not safe. It's not a trend. What it is that we've got increased awareness and we're now doing the backlog of all the people we missed. Mm-hmm. Being differently wired in our brains doesn't mean that we are better or worse. We're just left-handed in a right-handed world. It's essentially, finally, you get to have the pair of scissors that are meant for left-handed people instead of having that cramp of cutting the papers with the wrong scissors. Yeah. Language does matter, and especially for the neurodivergent community where there can be a tendency to take things literally, or maybe there's a lack of nuance, and fairness and justice tends to matter really deeply to those of us who are neurodivergent. So we have to be really careful to not fall into quite ableist language. Mm. And there's a lot of people in the community who don't even like the language around treating your ADHD because it's part of who I am. It's my brain. We don't want to say that we struggle with X, Y, and Z because that means letting go of the mask, and that's deeply vulnerable. Mm. A really good rule of thumb to remember to yourself if you're sitting as a practitioner is if you've met one neurodivergent person, you've met one neurodivergent person. I would much prefer it if someone approached this and got it a little bit wrong, but showed me the willingness to learn long-term masking, spending decades suppressing the ways that you really need to operate in the world for fear of being judged, for fear of not fitting in. That takes a toll on our nervous system. So much masking, so much people-pleasing and perfectionism to try to make sense of a world that is actually really relentless for us. They want to be validated and understood that all this stuff that I've been doing my whole life, that I've been feeling my whole life, that I've been thinking my whole life, it is not my fault. There is a reason in my brain why I've been getting into trouble or not getting stuff over the finish line. The nervous system just isn't regulated and they're not getting to operate in this neurotypical world the way that they need to.
Dr. Anna Colton, clinical psychologist.
It's one of many symptoms. However, rate often gives access to services. Did you grow up watching disordered eating? You know, functional, but disordered eating. Tell me about your pain. Tell me about your upset. Tell me about your distress. This is so difficult because actually the thing you're struggling with, you have to interact with 6 times a day. It's so hard. Food neutral is when we think all foods are equal. Food is just food. No food has a status that is different to another food. Dieting is a massive risk factor for the development of an eating disorder. And so if you haven't dieted before adulthood and then you start dieting, it can really kick off an eating disorder. Not for everybody, but for some. Shame thrives with secrecy and judgment and silence. Mm. You can't get to shame without naming shame, I think. Eva Musby's book on anorexia has become a massive guide for parents and clinicians. She came up with the division of responsibility model, which we also think about as responsive feeding, where the parent is in charge of what food they give and the child is in charge of how much they eat. Mm.
The big question is, when is it launching? Season 2 drops on Thursday, the 6th of February, 2025, and I'll release the episodes every other Thursday. You can listen on Apple, Spotify, or all the usual places. If you're a regular listener of Mastering Therapy, please do take a second to leave a review, subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to or watching this, or forward your favorite episode to someone that you think might benefit. If you want to appear on the podcast, you can get hold of me at Dr. Natalie Stott on LinkedIn or at masteringtherapy.com. I'll see you on the 6th.